Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We've got a great show for you this week. First up is President and Director General of the Tolerance Foundation, Anne Lagasse Dowson. She talks about how important it is to stop bullying and to have programs in place to help kids and adults see how destructive this behavior really is. We then talk to award-winning choreographer Tina Landon. Tina has worked with music's A-list, including Janet and Michael Jackson, Shakira, Rihanna, and Ricky Martin. She talks about her adventures and what she's gone through to stage some of the world's hottest music videos and tours.
Capture your need for sound.
Bullying has been around forever, but finally it seems that people are taking notice that this behavior should not be tolerated on any level, and that work needs to be done to banish this behavior from our schools, playgrounds, and even our places of employment. To give us some guidance on the subject is President and Director General of the Tolerance Foundation in Montreal, Anne Lagasse Dowson. Anne, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, Kelly, it's great to be with you.
And can you please tell us what the Tolerance Foundation is about and what it does for the community?
Well, it was founded about 15 years ago in the United Nations Year of Tolerance to try and address issues of discrimination and intimidation in the schools primarily. It was founded by a bunch of civic-minded Quebecers on the French side as well as on the Anglo side. And the feeling was that really there had to be sort of more awareness of, you know, discrimination issues, like sort of unspoken prejudice that people have about others that they don't know, right? So like this is a kind of a universal human trait, which is to sort of attribute negative prejudices to people that you don't know. This happens all across the board. The next step is to try and figure out a way of bridging and getting past those prejudices, because increasingly Quebec, Montreal, Canada is a diverse culture, and we're, you know, faced with all kinds of new and interesting people, and so the challenge is to try and get past that. So it was founded with that in mind. So initially, Foundation workshop leaders would go into schools with the Quebec Charter and talk about discrimination and racism. It became clear that there was way more work to be done in the schools around other, you know, issues of exclusion, such as homophobia, sexism, issues of appearance, prejudice based on appearances, and even dress code, kids with learning disabilities who are being marginalized. So it became then clear about 3 or 4 years ago that the foundation was going to have to start addressing issues of more open and overt discrimination in the form of bullying in the schools. So that's what they do. They do what's called the Tolerance Caravan in secondary schools, private and public, English and French, and they're now going into primary schools as well.
Now, you're working with the foundation here in Montreal, but on a global level, what do you think communities need to do to battle, you know, bullying and discrimination? Do you think there's, you know, a need for new creative methods to reach kids, teens, and adults?
Well, absolutely. Like, I think there's a much higher awareness of these kinds of exclusionary strategies or tactics and the suffering that they cost. I mean, we've seen a number of suicides here in Quebec that have made the news around issues of bullying. Last year, there was a young kid by the name of Maxime Collard who even organized a demonstration at his school in Sorel-Tracy to try and raise awareness around bullying, because he was a kind of an overweight kid who was targeted, and one of his good friends actually committed suicide. So, you know, this kind of exclusionary behavior can have really dire consequences. And so I think that the focus on suicide and mental health has raised awareness of bullying. And now there's a whole new thing that's opened up, which is the use of social media to marginalize and exclude people. People, you know, used to be able to go home and take shelter from the harassment they were suffering from at school, but then they just open their Facebook page and there's more of it, or there's, you know, stuff that goes on with texting. So I think overall the culture has become more aware of that, and people are, you know, prepared to tackle it in more direct ways. And one of the strategies we use, and which is increasingly being discussed in the literature, is trying to train the bystanders, the witnesses, to step up and intervene in some way. Because these kinds of things almost always happen with somebody standing by and watching and doing nothing. You know, so, I mean, Hannah Arendt, who's written a lot about genocide and you know, issues of exclusion and discrimination, talks about the beast in man is a sheep, she says in her work. And increasingly, that's sort of where the foundation and other people are focusing their attention, is on the bystanders, to get them to step up.
And do you think, Anne, because, you know, I think, I know when I was a kid, when you would say the word bully, the visual that would come to mind was like this bigger kid in the playground, you know, traumatizing a younger kid to steal his Twinkie. But it goes obviously much deeper than that. Do you find now with your position with the foundation that you're seeing in the community at large that people are treating it as a really serious issue, and that it's not just telling the kids, oh, you know, you just got to take your lumps and you'll get over it and then things will work out?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think people, parents and teachers, educators, grown-ups around the education system are taking this very seriously, partly because of what I was mentioning earlier, which is that increasingly we've been getting, you know, news stories about kids who end up feeling so bad and so marginal and so isolated that they end up ending their own lives, which is like the ultimate result of this kind of strategy. So my sense is that there is an overall increased awareness of these issues. And I think everybody is taking it seriously. There's more and more awareness in the workplace of how prejudice and discrimination can color or affect the way that we react to our coworkers in the workplace. Kids in high schools and universities are being asked to think more about this stuff. I mean, my sense is that there's sort of we've reached a watershed moment, especially in English Canada and in the United States, where there's increasingly a huge amount of awareness on this. And if you go to Twitter, there are numbers of anti-bullying or, you know, sort of organizations that look at these kinds of issues that are using Twitter to transmit the latest material on this. But but to go to your point about the bully, that the stereotype of the bully who is the big kid who bullies the younger kid, that's only like a fraction of what's really happening. Often the kid who is bullying other kids is a kid who has been victimized him or herself and is sort of lashing out and acting out as a way of venting their own frustration and pain. You know, there's no point in cracking down with these zero tolerance approaches to it. You have to, it's a problem of human relationships. You need to figure out why it's happening and go to the root of the thing, which is often that the kid who's doing it is in trouble, right? And then you can sort of bring the temperature down so that you can repair the broken human relationships, which are actually at the root of these kinds of behaviors.
What happens though, because I think like you mentioned, you know, if it is a kid that's being bullied, I would think that oftentimes it would be coming from his home life if he's then choosing to act out at school. So how, you know, what are the difficulties or challenges that you guys are facing in trying to reach maybe a home life that doesn't want to change their home life?
Well, you have to try and train the kids to think critically and sort of and empathically. Like one of the things I was mentioning, we try and talk to the bystanders, not just the perpetrators and the victims. We talk a lot about empathy in our workshops, like try and imagine a kid who's come into school, his or her parents are fighting a lot, or one of the parents has lost his or her job. There's a lot of tension at home, and you know, the kid's grades are falling, and so the kid is suddenly being targeted by other kids in the bathroom or in the stairwell, out of sight of the teachers. You know, like you want to take the kid aside or take the kid you want to talk to the kid in a class setting and say, look, you know, it's not okay for other kids to do this to you. Then you want to say to the perpetrators, it's not okay for you to behave this way. And you want to say to the kids who know this is happening, it's not okay for you to stand by and let this happen. So then the kids hopefully can transport some of that thinking back into the home. It's obvious that the parents also need to be informed about this stuff. And, you know, there are all kinds of people in the society with all kinds of ideas about this stuff. So one of the things the foundation is trying to do is raise its profile by doing interviews like this one, Kelly.
Excellent, excellent.
but also just to create a context in which this discussion can happen, because these things don't happen in isolation. There's a larger context, which is the school, which is the family, which is the community at large. And I think we probably all can think of a kid or an adult who is vulnerable. So the point is to reach out to that person in some small way. I mean, you don't have to become best friends with the people who are involved in these problem situations, but you need to sort of be aware of it. And if it's possible, intervene in some small positive way, because this thing is not addressed overnight. It takes perseverance to sort of break down these walls and break down these behaviors.
And what do you tell, or, you know, teachers who are on the front lines? Because I feel like they are the ones that are on the front lines, at least in the schools, obviously in the playgrounds, that are witnessing this behavior. Is it that teachers as well need more expert training on how to handle it, so that it's not just either that specific situation is just placated, or, you know, the fact that they really need to address it large scale and get the word out throughout their school?
Well, I think a lot of teachers are already aware of it, and they're doing their best. Many of them are doing as much as they can to try and tackle this stuff. They talk to the kids about it. I mean, when we go into the schools and say to the kids, you know, has any of you ever been intimidated or bullied? Almost all the kids raise their hands. And then we say to them, so have you ever sort of talked to grown-ups about this? And a lot of the kids will say, yes, I've talked to my teachers about it. And the teachers will say to us, we know who's being targeted. We try the best we can, but we don't have eyes in the back of our heads. And, you know, a lot of, you know, kids live their lives out of, you know, the direct line of sight of adults, including teachers. So most of the teachers are very clued in on this stuff, and they're talking about this stuff. The question is how to teach skills to kids and to, you know, young people, the skills that are required and the confidence that is required to say, you know, I don't think that's cool what you're doing. That is not okay to talk to that kid like that and to call him a faggot or to call that girl a slut. That is not okay, and you can't do that when I'm around. And to be, you know, sort of ready to take the heat, because often once a kid steps up, the concern is that they then become targets of bullying themselves, right? So you have to give the kids the confidence and hopefully the backup of their friends to be able to step up like that and not feel like they then become targets. So it's a real challenge for the adults in the education system. And they need all the help and backup they can get from parents, from the foundation, from the media, you know, that they can get.
Joining us on the show right now is Anne Lagacé-Dowson, President and Director General of the Tolerance Foundation in Montreal. Make sure to check it out, www.fondationtolerance.com. Now, Anne, you know, in the news, it seems lately, but it's been going on, you know, for at least a couple of years, I think, where people are very cognizant of the fact that there's so much bullying going on now that is at least getting press with regards to a person's sexuality. And in the last year or so, it seems like there's been so many documented cases of suicide because, you know, that person, usually a student, whether it's in high school or university, was being attacked in some form for being gay. So do you think that this is a growing trend, and what needs to be done about it?
I don't know if it's a growing trend. I think it's been going on for a long time. I mean, I don't know, you know, what some of your listeners experienced at school, but I mean, the easy thing for guys to do is label a guy that's a bit different or a bit unusual or a bit, you know, creative, or just a guy they don't like, to label that guy a fag. I mean, that, you know, that goes back decades, generations. I mean, there's a lot of, and we're talking about people sort of at the cusp in terms of their own personal identity, their sexual identity. There are a lot of question marks. People are going through all kinds of hormonal changes. So they're super vulnerable to this kind of stuff. Like, this is going on right across the board. You know, try to figure out what your identity is and what your orientation is. I think there's just, like, to the credit of a lot of us, you know, there's a new vocabulary to address this issue, and it's being dealt with openly, and there's been a lot of campaigning and strategizing by the gay and lesbian communities to raise the profiles of, you know, these kinds of issues around homophobia. Like, I mean, and that goes to the HIV/AIDS movement and awareness about HIV/AIDS. I mean, like, suddenly the society is actually talking about these issues, whereas before they were sort of hidden and latent. So I think it's a real, you know, there's real progress. And the fact that the kids who are marginalized are speaking up more and more, too, is a real credit to the society. So, but one of the things we are finding a lot in the schools is that the kid will say to the kids, so what kind of, you know, intimidation and verbal abuse are you hearing in the school? And a lot of it has to do with sexual orientation. So there's a lot of work to be done on that one. In some ways, it's kind of like a new frontier, the discrimination, marginalization based on sexual orientation. So we need to be a lot more gay positive, and we need to be a lot more fearless about this stuff.
Now, in your opinion, with regards to this specific type of bullying where it's about a person's sexual orientation, do you think, you know, like if we take it down to street level, like, you know, grade 7, grade 8, grade 9, you know, if you know, you're in the school and you see, like you mentioned before, there's a kid, a boy who is, you know, creative, like you said, and just doesn't fit that standard, you know, hockey type of boy. Do you think that the discrimination is coming because the kids have gone home and said to their parents, you know, there's this boy that I don't really understand what he's about, and that's where it's coming from? Or do you think it's a collective of the kids at school not being okay with this boy being different?
I think it goes to the sort of vestiges of a very conservative attitude towards sexuality, which many of us have inherited from various religious institutions and religious practices. It comes from a sort of an uneasiness in the culture about homosexual relationships between women and men. I mean, it's not just young, potentially gay men who are getting hassled. It's also young lesbians as well. I mean, it's sort of a an old-fashioned attitude which is being challenged. And I think I don't have to tell you, like, if you look in the mainstream media, some of our own politicians, certain political entities in the United States, conservative sort of lobby groups, they're not comfortable with gay marriage and with a lesbian lifestyle and parenting of gay and lesbian couples and all that. I mean, the society is still confronting a lot of prejudice. So I think kids are going home and they're hearing some of that from their parents. But the reality is that the society is changing, and these young people know that. And they have friends who are gay and lesbian. They may be themselves. So the challenge is to bolster them up and support them and tell them that it is okay to be that, to be yourself, whatever that is. And so, like, my sense is that the society is really changing on this front, but that there's a lot of sort of old baggage that is being dragged into the schools by kids, possibly from their families, possibly from their various religious practices. I mean, there are certain religions that are more open to gay and lesbian lifestyles than others. I mean, you know, Canada is a multicultural, very diverse society, so we're getting ideas from all over the place. The challenge is to sort of, apply the charter on the ground in daily life. You know, we are all equal, and our sexual orientation is nobody's business but our own.
And something I wanted to ask you about as well, I was reading about a school in Milwaukee called The Alliance that caters to gay and transgendered youth. Now, the kids that apparently attend the school say they feel, you know, very safe in that environment, that it's a home away from home. They don't have to worry about being bullied or discriminated against, you know, in this school. And I guess the question I would have is, are schools like this the answer, or is this the beginning of, you know, a type of segregation that could backfire?
I think probably for some kids, a school like that is the answer, but I take your point about it being potentially sort of almost like a ghetto. Like, I think, you know, this debate happened in the universities around the whole question of women's studies. Should we be setting up departments that would focus on the history of women and, the social sciences and the study of women, because women have largely been excluded from, you know, the written record of our culture? And I think there's a place for both. I mean, the fact of the matter is you live in a larger society, there's going to have to be integration at some point. But if certain kids are super vulnerable, then I'm not opposed to them going to a school like that while they sort of consolidate and figure out who they are and then go out into the larger world feeling much more confident. So I suspect that maybe the answer is both things. Like, the kids need to be working toward integration, but maybe they need a certain period where they can sort of have a refuge and a safe, you know, harbor to sort of work on feeling more confident about themselves. But the idea is integration. I mean, we all live together and we all want to be able to contribute in our own way in a larger society, not in silos separated from each other.
Yeah, well, because that was the thing that struck me while I was watching this, because when I first was watching and sort of reading, I read an article and watched a report on it. When I first was watching it, you know, I felt happy for these kids, because you could just see, you know, how grateful they are to sort of be with one another that are in the same boat. But then as I continued to watch the report, it kind of just frightened me a little, because I'm like, this could end in a bad place in the fact that, you know, people are going to be segregated from one another, and then they might be persecuted for wanting to be in a situation like that, where, you know, these high moral ground religious types saying, oh, well, they all want to be in their same, you know, neck of the woods anyway, let's leave them there. So that it kind of frightens me. And I think you're right. I think integration is the way that they need to head with this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, who would want to live in a society where everybody is the same? I mean, really, I think that is the most dull prospect. I mean, the interesting thing about life is how other people are and how they think and why they do the things that they do. I mean, that makes the society that much richer and that much more creative. So I think, you know, integration is the long-term goal. But sometimes it may be that some kids might need to be able to go off and form a little kind of caucus of their own until they feel comfortable and confident enough to go out into the world. And I don't see any kind of contradiction with that. Like, it's the debate a little bit around all-girl schools, for example.
Right.
You know, there's a feeling that sometimes all girls do better when they're only in an all-girl school. And there's other people who say, well, actually, the evidence sort of is a bit contradictory. So I think that the idea of the foundation is in the title of it, which is the Tolerance Foundation. I mean, we start with a concept of tolerance. We hopefully move to a level of understanding, and then eventually to a level of respect. You know, you don't have to be like your neighbor, but you need to respect your neighbor and hopefully be able to communicate clearly with that person. Now, that may sound like pie in the sky, but that in some ways is the basis of the country we live in. Canada was founded by Protestants, Catholics, French, English, in order to try and surpass or get past the conflicts of the old world and build some kind of new thing. We take in 250,000 immigrants every year based on that concept. So we all need to be taking a page from each other's book and learning from each other. And hopefully that's what the foundation will help to do.
And for people who, you know, may be listening right now who are in a neighborhood, because again, you know, the show's online and it goes worldwide. What do you say to people who may be in a community where they don't necessarily have like the Tolerance Foundation like we are fortunate to have here in Montreal? What do you suggest that they do if they're looking for help, especially if they're trying to help their child deal with horrible situations?
Well, I think one of the things they could do is go to our Facebook page. There's a number of references on our Facebook page. We're now up on Twitter as of this week. So, you know, if anybody's sort of looking around for things and people to follow, we'd be super happy to engage with people using the social media. There's a lot of material on the internet. If you Google bullying, you'll find all kinds of resources. I mean, this is a debate that's going on all around the world. And in some ways, kids need their parents to act as advocates. If your kid is in trouble, then you need to be starting to do some research and maybe acquiring some knowledge about this. There's a network across Canada called PrevNet, based in Kingston, that does a lot of really interesting work. So once you start looking, you'll be amazed to find how many people are struggling with a lot of these issues around integration and inclusion in the society, not just in Canada, but really around the world.
Anne, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Take care, Kelly.
Thank you. That's Anne Lagasse-Dowson, again, President and Director General of the Tolerance Foundation in Montreal. Check them out, www.fondationtolerance.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's a complete honor to welcome my next guest to the show. She's provided the most amazing steps, moves, and staging for some of the world's top artists, including Rihanna, Shakira, Ricky Martin, Britney Spears, Jennifer Lopez, Christina Aguilera, and Michael and Janet Jackson. She's won a ton of awards for her work in dance, including the ALMA Award for Achievement in Choreography, as well as MTV Video Music Awards for Best Choreography for Ricky Martin's Living La Vida Loca and for Michael and Janet Jackson's Scream. Tina Landon, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show. You have a long list of accomplishments. It's very good. So Tina, I have to start off, I guess, you know, because you've done so much, but I kind of want to bring it down to the beginning. How did you get into the world of dance? Was it something that you actually wanted to do, or did your parents sort of ship you off to dance class as a six-year-old?
Actually, I started at three. So it was definitely my parents putting me into dance because I was way too young to even know what it was at the time. My mom was always, she always wanted to dance, but she came from a family of eight brothers and sisters, so they couldn't afford it. I mean, she was like more of, you know, the party club type dancer, but so she put my sister, myself, and my brother all in dance when we were very, very young. So that's where it all started for me.
And when did you know that dancing was a career that you wanted to pursue?
Oh, gosh. Probably, you know, it was one of those things that I was in high school, and I remember seeing, gosh, I don't know, it was probably without dating myself, but it was probably Flashdance or Fame or one of those that kind of, you know, I had been dancing all my life, but all we ever did was go and perform at the county fair, and that was our big yearly event for all the dance lessons throughout the year. And when I saw that there were other avenues for dance, because, you know, I was quite sheltered growing up in such a small town. So I didn't grow up on Broadway musicals and that whole other side of the world. I grew up, you know, like I said, dancing at the fairgrounds. And then if I wanted to become a professional dancer, most of my friends would go to Vegas where you had to dance topless. So I definitely was not interested in that. So I have to say when I finally saw something brought to my, you know, living room, via television, that's when I thought, oh, this is really, really cool. But I still never imagined that I'd have a career. It was kind of something that I thought I would do for a little while I was getting a teaching degree or something. But I knew that I would always come back and teach dance or be involved in dance. I just never thought my career would take off the way it did.
What was your first big break?
Well, my first big break, you know, it's hard because you feel like there's so many different windows that all lead to bigger windows.
Right.
But I would say as far as a dancer, I have worked some television stuff prior, but I think really when it started to take off was when I did what have you done for me lately, the Janet Jackson, what have you done for me lately video. I think that was kind of my first taste of the video world and the video life, and that's, and from there it's kind of where it expanded for me.
And I think some of your fans, well, I think maybe, you know, there's questions where, was it that you knew Paula Abdul first, or was it that you met Janet first? Like, it just seems like, I think some of us weren't sure, you know, was it Paula that brought you to Janet, or, you know, how did your relationship start with Janet?
Let me think about that. Actually, no, I knew Paula first. Paula and I used to teach dance camps together in the summers. And then it was one of those where you kind of, you know, what is it, six degrees of separation.
Okay.
So on one hand, I knew Paula, and I also knew Renee and Terry Bixler and Anthony Thomas, because they were all in a dance group together called the LA City Rockers. At the same time, Paula and I started working together, Renee and Janet were very, very good friends. They weren't dating at the time, but they were friends. So it was kind of like this weird combination of us all knowing the same people at the same time. And so it was more of my introduction through Paula to Janet on that video shoot. And it just turned out that we all ended up going, oh wait, we all know the same people.
Okay. And then a question too, because like you danced with Janet, you know, during those late 80s on that video. And then, you know, you came back together again with her, obviously, on the Rhythm Nation project. Now, I always had a question. Did you sort of get that job because you've worked with her in the 80s, or did you have to re-audition for the Rhythm Nation project?
No, I definitely had to re-audition for the Rhythm Nation project.
Wow. Okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. And it was, you know, again, like we all knew the same people. So there was the guy that I was dating at the time was best friends with Anthony Thomas. They had a huge falling out, which put me kind of like, wait, I didn't do anything. But I was kind of not ousted, but just, you know, the throwing out the baby with the, well, what is it? No, throwing out the
bathwater with the baby
with the bathwater kind of thing. So it was definitely, I almost did not go to that audition because I thought Anthony hates my boyfriend. He's never going to give me a fair shot. And it was actually Terry Bixler, who also worked on the Rhythm Nation project. He was the one who begged me to come. No, no, no. They promised they're going to give you a fair shot. I was like, I'm not going. There's no way. He hates me. And he hates me because he hates my boyfriend. And I went and I booked it. And they gave me a fair shot. So
wow, that's
they kept
awesome.
The word.
That's amazing. And what was it like to work on that Rhythm Nation project, Tina? Because it just seemed like this was such a huge project for Janet to really get legs.
You know, it was really one of those, it was really, really cool because, you know, Anthony and Terry's style was so different from what the dance world had seen. They were such a fusion of street and kind of like the street jazz, because neither one of them were trained dancers. So it was fun and interesting, and you could kind of feel with the music, with the dance, it was kind of this underlining feeling of we're doing something really cool and really new without, you know, boasting about it or running around going, this is going to be the coolest thing ever. It was like this weird underlying feeling of, wow, something's happening here. That's really, really different and really, really cool. And you just felt it while you were involved with the entire rehearsal production side of it. It was really, really cool.
And what was it like to go out on tour with Janet for that Rhythm Nation project? Because again, that was like her breakout, it felt, and it just felt like she really needed to have you strong dancers with her.
That was probably one of the most exciting times of my life as a dancer, because I just, you know, again, it was something I'd never dreamed of happening or thought of. At that time, there just wasn't a lot of tours, you know, that had dancers, not pop artists. And so it wasn't anything I aspired to do because I didn't even know it existed. And originally, that tour was supposed to only have the four boys. But once we did the Rhythm Nation long-form video, and Jen and I were hanging out again, and then Karen, who was one of the twins in the video, who ended up also getting the tour, it just really happened organically. We had been, she wanted to kind of dance and work out prior, you know, to get herself in shape for the tour. So Karen and I would meet with her and just make up routines and dance for exercise. And in the middle of one of our rehearsals, Renee came in and was talking about the tour, and we're just like, okay, this is really great. I mean, you guys are going to have a lot of fun. And he kept saying, you guys. And I'm like, I'm looking at Karen going, what is he talking about? And it was this really weird thing. It was like, oh my gosh, we haven't even told you. We want you guys to come on tour with us. And I didn't tell anyone for like a month because I thought, this is not, no. He's pulling my leg because that's Renee. He's joking with us. I didn't tell my family. I told them on Thanksgiving. And it had been a month that I was sitting on it because I just wanted to be sure this was really, really going to happen.
Wow, that's awesome. And when you headed out on tour, what was it like, Tina? Because, you know, just all those fans. And I obviously, I'm assuming that was your first tour. So it must have just been overwhelming in a way.
Oh, it was. It was exciting. It was surreal. I remember buying my first video camera. And I had no idea how to use it. I was like reading it on the plane. It was my first trip to Europe. It was so many first things, and then going and watching like the fans and the craziness, and you know, they'd be at the hotel before us, they were there at the airport, they would be at our bus. I'm like, how do you guys know all this stuff? I don't even know where we're going from day to day. And then you'd start meeting friends and you start making friends, and you just started to really appreciate the fans and how much they loved her and how much they were affected by everything that we did. I mean, we ended up getting our own cards and our own fans and our own gifts, you know, after the shows. And it was pretty, pretty surreal to just have to take all of that in. You know, just there was just so much going on at one time for a little dancer from Lancaster, California, you know. But it was very, very exciting.
And how did you then transition, I guess I'll use the word, from being one of her dancers to taking on a more, like a bigger role? Like I know you were helping her out a lot with Love Will Never Do Without You video. And then obviously you became her choreographer for the Janet Project. How was that?
Well, you know, that evolved over the years of us working together. And I think it started when we were in the middle of the Rhythm Nation rehearsal process. We were falling a little bit behind schedule. And everything was very frustrating. It was very new for everyone. You know, it was Janet's first big tour. It was Anthony's first big job. A lot of us had worked prior to that and kind of knew, you know, I had come from a teaching and studio background. So I kind of, we were at a point where Janet was like, oh, I think we need longer hours, longer. I'm going, and I had to just go, guys, can I make a suggestion? Because I'm dying going, we don't need longer hours. We just need more productivity. We need to be doing this, this, and this. And the next thing I knew, I came in, and Terry was like, what did you say to Janet last night? I said, what? You know, and he just starts laughing. He goes, well, she wants you to come and stage some of the numbers. I went, oh, I just didn't want to be here any longer. So I was suggesting, I just gave her some suggestions so we didn't have to have 12-hour rehearsals. So that's kind of where I started. And from that, I think she got to see what my background was and what I knew about dance and how long I've been choreographing. And so when that, after Rhythm Nation, by the end of the tour, she said that she was going to go in a different direction. I'm like, okay, whatever. And wanted me to just kind of help her with more of the girly stuff because she knew that I understood the tomboy side of her because I was also a tomboy. But that I could pull out that femininity in her because of the background of dance that I had. And that's what you see in The Love Will Never Do. A lot of that, I tell people, it's really just me on the other side of the camera, just doing, like, nothing was choreographed for that. It was just me standing behind the camera moving and her basically emulating that. And a lot of the times where you see her laughing, I mean, that was really laughing because I would do something super girly and she would just die, like, I'm not going to do that. And then from that, the way that the whole Velvet Rope thing happened in between tours, you know, I would always go back to teaching and working for other artists and things. And I was so excited about this school in Japan that I had been teaching at. And I really wanted her to see these Japanese dancers because they were amazing. And one day I was showing her, I had done a number for the teachers, and it was to Michael Jackson's, what was it, Jam, I think was the name of the song.
Yeah.
And I was showing her the dancers. I wasn't even thinking that I was showing her my work. So it was really organic how it kind of happened. And then the next thing I knew, her and Renee were in another room whispering and stuff. And next thing I knew, they were saying that they wanted me. At this point, I don't think they were sure. So they wanted me to be that kind of the head of choreography and maybe bring in some other choreographers for the Velvet Rope project. And I was like, okay, sure. I mean, I'm sorry, not the Velvet Rope project, the Janet project.
Okay.
I said, okay. So then after I did the choreography for If, there was just no talk of any other choreographers, and it was just, I just kept getting handed the next one and the next one and the next one. And before I turned around, I was doing the whole Janet tour.
Wow. That's awesome. And what was it like, Tina, in that? Was it like that you were in a, because it just seemed like there was so much going on then too, because she was kind of heading in a bit of a different direction, I think, like once the fans saw the album or listened to the album, was it like you were in a bubble just trying to keep creating?
It was a bubble. It wasn't, how can I say? It was just, you know, I was so used to having to make one routine after another for teaching purposes, for teaching at camp or teaching at dance conventions. So to me, it was kind of the same thing in that, okay, what's next? Okay, we got to do this. Okay, what's next? We got to do this. And literally, I didn't think about this gigantic tour that stood before me. It was just, what song do we have to accomplish today? What are we going to do for this song? What's the look for that one? What are we wearing for this one? So it was a bubble in a sense, but it was a creative place that I was very used to.
Okay. And what was it like, Tina, you know, because I'm assuming as well, this was your first time having to audition dancers, like for such a big project and stuff. I'm assuming everybody and their grandmother was sending you tapes or showing up to auditions. What was it like, that process? Because, you know, from things I've heard over the years, it just sounded like there were so many dancers that wanted to get on that tour or that project. It just must have been a lot of work to cut everything down and get the dancers you needed.
It was. I think, you know, for me as a dancer, I was so used to going to all of them that it didn't surprise me the turnout that we had. I was used to seeing hundreds of dancers and being one of those hundreds of dancers just waiting for my turn to go. But, you know, really in reality, there's always, you know, 1,000 people can show up, but there's still going to be the same percentage that can really do the work and that really should be there. So, you know, we got some pretty funny tapes that were very, very interesting, some homemade tapes. There was a couple of people showing up that were completely wrong for it, you know, and you just kind of have to go through it. But it was also a really exciting time to see dancers really, really hungry for work and really putting their, you know, their best foot forward. And so that was really fun to be a part of.
And was it, I guess, difficult to get down to those final dancers, which ended up, you know, being with you for a while, like Kelly and Nikki, and you know, it just seemed like there was a bunch of them that you ended up keeping for the next project.
Yeah, you know, with the Janet project, it was really interesting because I think at that time she had been working on Poetic Justice, and there were some girls that she had met at that time. So when we first, we're putting that tour together, she kind of already had like 4 or 5 girls in mind, which scared me in the sense that I thought, I didn't know the girls, but I knew the background that they had, and it was really only one thing, which was hip-hop. And so I'm thinking, how do we do this? Because now they're her friends, or they're her hangout buddies. She wants them as dancers, but they really don't have the background. They really don't have what I knew was going to sustain a tour. And really, you know, it's just one of those things you go, okay, and kind of let God take care of it, which he did, because one by one, they just started to fall away and kind of exclude themselves by their own, you know, demise. And really, once we had the audition and we started to put the pieces together, it kind of just all fell together. And, you know, with the Janet thing, again, that was Jennifer Lopez was one of the original dancers.
Right.
And then she left. So it just all kind of melted and worked, and the people that were supposed to be there were the ones that stayed.
What was it like, I guess, doing the If video? Because I think that is for a lot of Janet fans and a lot of your fans, it's like one of the first times that we see just how, I mean, just it, that is a groundbreaking video, and the choreography, like everyone knows the breakdown part. What was that like? A crazy, like, I can't even imagine what it must be like for you to know that you did that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the breakdown part was actually the hardest part. I mean, I had everything done except for that. And every time we would come to that rehearsal, we'd all just start doing our own thing, you know, and just kind of seeing what landed. And like, no, that's not going to work. No. And then Janet was like, you know what, why don't you get with Omar and just see what you guys come up with. Omar had been in his own dance group prior to us picking him for the tour. And I was like, okay, so it was me and Sean Cheeseman. I think it was Sean Cheeseman. Yeah. Wait, was he there?
I think so.
It's like they all the tours start to mesh together.
Yeah, well,
and Omar. Okay. And we were just vibing one day. And it was like, Omar would do an 8 count. I would do an 8 count. And then Omar was like, yeah, let's do that. And then we'll go into this. And so it was really him and I just kind of pulling the best of what we could come up with that day and making it all work.
Which was just fantastic. And then when you, I guess, you know, a couple of years went by, you know, and then with regards to the Janet projects, when you came to the Velvet Rope Tour, that was your last one that you worked with Janet full time on. For your fans, like it felt like for Tina Landon fans and like me too, like I fully just remember watching that, going to the concerts and just seeing like it felt like you poured, you know, your heart and soul into that project. What was it like for you to create that tour? And does it still, you know, hold a special place in your heart?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Velvet Rope, I've always called my baby. Like that was, and I did. I mean, I did tears, bled, got hurt. I mean, I poured every ounce of everything I had into that tour. And, you know, it was one of those things that I just think it was everything aligning itself. You know, the music, I was in love with every single song on that album. And for me, the music is everything. The music drives me to create. And there was just, I just can't even tell you how the music touched me. It was, and, you know, as well as the Janet album, I was there when it was being created. And it's a whole other process when you get to be involved that early on, as opposed to nowadays. You know, I'm lucky if I have 2 days before a video. I mean, I've shown on video shoots, and they're like, okay, you know, are you guys ready? I'm like, can I hear the music? Like, guys,
wow.
Really? You know, it's like, I don't know what you want me to do here. I don't even know what the song is. It's like way out of control. So being a part
of like the recording process,
created.
Okay. Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Of like being part of the recording process, because it, you know, for people who don't know, you were actually on the Janet album in Throb.
Right. And I mean, we were in a bunch of that stuff. You know, she would always pull the girls in and, you know, or the guy, whatever she needed. And it was awesome. So that alone being a part of it from the beginning, it just kind of helped guide me kind of through everything. And I really just felt like at that point, Janet really had a lot of trust in just letting me go with, hey, I want to do this for this number. Hey, for you, you know, I really want to put these masks on and I want it to be weird because the music's weird and mysterious underneath. And, you know, her and I would always go to these Cirque du Soleil shows that we just loved. And that was also a big inspiration for me for that tour. And just trying to find different ways to move because, you know, again, this was her third tour. We've been doing the same song. Like, how do we make everything more exciting? And really, like I said, it just all stemmed from that album being so incredibly musically strong that it just kind of took over me.
Was it a difficult thing, Tina, for you guys? Because like you said, at that point, you know, that's her third tour. She's also coming off like, you know, four strong albums. What was it like to put the set list together? Because it just seems like there was so much to have to now, you know, pare down, I guess, because there's so many hit songs that she had going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could have easily done a 4-hour concert. But, you know, and that was the other thing that was amazing is that her and I always put the set list together. Like, I was always a part of that. So we would just really kind of start with, okay, these are the songs we have to do. And there'd be like 40 of them. Like, okay, well, we can't be up there for 4 hours. So what? And Janet, you know, she was always very, very particular about wanting to keep the sound familiar, not sway too much away from the original concept of the song or the vibe of the song. And really, it was like at your third tour, I'm going, well, I think now we can kind of, you know, can we do this version that you did on the Grammys? And, you know, nowadays it's a lot different because with YouTube, with everything, and everyone's got ADD, nobody wants to see the same performance twice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the fans loved about Janet and Michael, was just they would go to the shows to see that choreography because they spent so many hours at home learning it. They didn't want to see a different version. They didn't want, but you know, by the third tour, it's like, okay, well, we're going to give them that so that they can dance with us in the front row and completely confuse us while we're up here. We're going to give them that part of it, but we're also going to give them a twist and give the twist for the ones that have been coming and do want something different. So I think that was the hardest part for Janet. It was like, I want to keep it. She was always, always, always about the fans. I want to do this for the fans. I want to make sure the fans like this. I want to make sure. It was hardly ever like, this is what I want to do. She wanted to do things, but she always had to, she wanted to keep the integrity for the fans first.
And when you were, I guess, deciding through the set list, like how certain songs would go into each other and stuff, was that a hard mm-hmm. process as well? Like just for things to match? Because like the one thing that jumps out of my head right now is, I guess, near the end of the concert when you guys would go from That's the Way Love Goes and Got Till It's Gone. And like it was all sort of melt. It just went perfect. Like, was that like trial and error kind of thing? Or did you have a good sense that these are the songs that should go together?
Yeah, I think that's after knowing them for so long and, you know, I have a musical background, obviously, Janet, and then Rex, who was our musical director at the time. And that's one of my favorite things to do, is to work with the musical director and go, okay, let's do a segue here. Like, you know, I lean on them to say, yes, these two songs are in the same chords. They'll blend perfectly together. Obviously, when you're working with someone like Janet, she already knows that. So she'll know in her head that these two songs will go together, and then the three of us will get together and go, okay, how do we make this work? And I just love that process, because I can sit there. I mean, I remember one time we were doing, I think this was for the Janet tour, right? When we did the Nunchucks, so was that for?
That was on Velvet Rope, I believe.
That Velvet Rope. Mm-hmm. Okay. I remember we hadn't created that part yet of the song. And that was something, okay, we've given the integrity of the song and the choreography to the fans. Now let's give them something extra. So when we did the Nunchuck part, I remember being at rehearsal. By now we're in production rehearsals with Rex in catering. And he's like, so what are you feeling? And we were just banging it out on the tables and my thighs. Like, this is the rhythm. Like, give me something like that. And he's like, okay. And I was like, I need it for the X amount of times. And we were just all banging it out on the tables. And then next thing I know, he's with the band. I'm like, that's it. That's what we need. So a lot of that stuff just, it's really not hard, because we love to do that part of it.
And where did those ideas come from, Tina? Because like you said, like using the martial arts for the Velvet Rope tour was just insane. I think no one thought that Janet was going to come out with martial arts weapons and start doing the stuff with all of you guys. And then like the skateboards.
She didn't either.
Yeah, she didn't. You surprised her, did you?
Yeah.
So where did those inspirations come from, Tina? Because it was just like, it was like a, like I saw the tour four times, like the Velvet Rope tour. And had I been able see it like nine times, I would have done it too. Because, and in each of those four times, I just felt like I didn't see that before. You know, like it was, there's always something that I'd missed in the previous show that I'd seen. So it just seems like it was a visual and, you know, obviously an audio extravaganza.
Awesome. Well, you know, I have a background in martial arts. It's not, I mean, I'm not a black belt or anything, but I've always had this love, this deep love for it. And I've studied it, but dance always came first. I'm like, I'm not breaking any boards because I need my feet to dance. So I only do it so much, but I have this love for it. So anytime that I can, even with my choreography, a lot of things I will pull from martial arts, whether it's a kick or the way your hands move or a style, a vibe of it. So it was just one of those things that was like, okay, well, what can we do? And I had always wanted to do a number with Nunchucks, and it just so happened, I'm like, this is the perfect song for it. And Janet was like, okay, great. And it was funny because I think for the first few shows, she would leave on that part. And like, because she didn't feel confident enough yet to do it. And then, of course, her jacket was much longer, and you always have to adapt for a wardrobe. But finally, I think about the fifth show in, I would look at her all the time, like, okay, are you going to bail? Are you going to stay out here and do it? Are you going to bail? And then she just would start, you know, staying out there and doing it. It was great.
Is it true that she belted herself in the head one time or something and stopped doing it for a few shows? Because that was a rumor going around that she took herself out one time and then didn't do it for a while.
I don't remember, okay. But I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, we all bonked ourselves pretty good at those things.
And something I have to ask you too, Tina, like when you guys came out to do Throb, because especially on the Velvet Rope Tour, like obviously you guys were all tricked out in the Adidas gear and it was just so much fun. What was it like to choreograph that? Did you let each of the dancers sort of decide their freestyle? Or I know there was, because there was times where you were dancing as a group. So was it a collaborative effort then to put that one together?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I feel, you know, freestyle in the sense of the world is freestyle. So I never wanted to choreograph that four people, but I felt that if it was just one big freestyle thing, it's going to be a big mess here on stage, and we're not going to capture the whole circle vibe. And the whole thing that we love about freestyle and going to the clubs is being able to be a part of it, but it's like, okay, how do you keep that vibe, and how do you get the audience to see it and still have a performance on stage? So that was why there were certain sections that I felt needed to be synchronized and needed to be together. But then as far as each person solo or the group step, I'm like, you guys, you know, everyone, when you're a dancer, you know what works for you. And we had such incredible dancers and incredible freestyles. I'm like, okay, this is your point in the song, do whatever you want to do. This is your point in the song, do whatever you want to do. And then there were some times that Omar and I would collaborate on the synchronicity of some of the movement as well.
That's the amazing Tina Landon. And the funny thing is, she and I were only supposed to talk for about 10 to 15 minutes about her career, but we got into such an awesome conversation that I actually have more audio for you, and I want to run it for you, but we're going to do it next week. So you've just heard part one of my chat with choreographer Tina Landon, and next week you're going to hear part two, which involves some talk about her working with Rihanna. She's had a 5-year working relationship with Rihanna. We're going to talk about that, as well as her involvement in the 2009 MTV Video Music Awards tribute that Janet did for her brother Michael. Tina was a part of that, and it was such a mind-blowing performance. I think everyone and their grandmother on that night made sure that they were watching their television screens to see what Janet was going to come up with to honor Michael, who at that time had just passed away just a few months before. So we get into all of that, as well as what it was like for Tina to work with Michael. She actually choreographed that hit video Scream back in 1995, and so she gets into more detail about what it was like to work with the two very famous Jacksons, Janet and Michael. So that's coming up next week right here on The Kelly Alexander Show. quickly this hour just flew by. I hope you had as much fun as I did. A big thank you going out to my guests and Lagasse Dowson as well as Tina Landon. And again, Tina is going to be back on the show next week to wrap up our interview talking about working with Rihanna as well as what an experience it was for her to choreograph for the one and only Michael Jackson. As per usual, I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Mark Twain. Keep away from those who try to belittle your ambitions. Small people always do that, but the really great make you believe that you too can become great. Have an excellent week. Thank you so much for hanging out. Any comments or questions, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I'll chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.